I'd like to welcome you to the last of the 6 engagement and telelearning sessions that are leading up to the exciting 2010 summit on a people-centered economy, which is taking place May 30th to June 2nd in Ottawa. So again, thank you very much for joining us. I believe we have 60 people registered, so that's a terrific number. As I said, please mute your phones using star 6 and just use star 6 again to rejoin the conversation. And you can also join the chat room, which I mentioned, www.chatsy.com/CSEHub. And my name is Leslie Brown. I'm the director of the Social Economy and Sustainability Research Network, the Atlantic node of the Social Economy Research Partnerships. And you can find us at Social Economy Atlantic, so just go Social Economy Atlantic and it'll take you there. I'm also a sociologist and the chair of the Department of Sociology and Anthropology at Mount St. Vincent University. The CSE Hub is a national social economy research program, and it's co-led by the University of Victoria and the Canadian CED Network. It involves practitioner organizations and universities across Canada with the National Hub and the 6 regional centers in different parts of the country. And one of those centers is our Atlantic node. Through funding from the federal government, the Social Sciences and Humanities Research Council, these groups of researchers and practitioners have been doing research to understand how the approaches of the social economy can be better understood and effectively applied so that community organizations, civil society, community developers, and researchers can collaborate to empower groups and communities to meet their social and economic needs. So the session today is the 6th of the engagement and telelearning sessions building up to the summit, as I said. And today we're going to be talking about partnership and movement building. And I believe you've all had access to 2 papers, the CSE Hub Knowledge Mobilization Paper, Management and Governance for the Social Economy, by Rupert Downing, Mike Toy, and Alexandre Charron. And the second is the National Summit Issue Paper, Strengthening the Movement for a People-Centered Economy, by Rupert Downing and Mike Lewis. I've already mentioned that there is a chat room. Not seeing too many people joining, but some are. And again, it's www.chatsy.com/CSEHub. The first speakers will be Rupert Downing and Alexandre Charron. Rupert is the former executive director of the Canadian CED Hub, and he's also the co-director for the Canadian Social Economy Research Hub, the CSE Hub that I've just been mentioning. He and Alexandre have co-authored the first paper that will be discussed. Mike Lewis is the managing director of the Canadian Centre for Community Renewal and director and lead investigator for the BC Alberta Social Economy Research Network. Throughout the call and during the discussion, if you'd like to direct a question to us verbally, that would be terrific. If you'd prefer to type a question in, simply put question and the question that you would like to pose, and I'll try to monitor both of them. So, Rupert, would you like to start?
Leslie, and welcome, everybody. It's great to have everybody joining the call today. And also, of course, in addition to this call, there are going to be opportunities on the Canadian CED Network website to engage and make comments on the papers that are being produced for the summit coming up at the end of May in Ottawa. And there'll be other engagement opportunities. I'm going to deal with some of the international and national research we've been doing and then hand over to Alex, who's going to talk more specifically about the in-depth comparative research that he's done on the development of organizations for the social economy in Manitoba and Quebec. So the question that we're really posing today and asking for people's input on is learning from what's been happening in Canada and in other parts of the world What is it that we can do to try and strengthen the governance and partnership and movement building of organizations in the social economy across Canada, in our local areas, in our provinces, and nationally? The international research that we've been doing at the Hub has really been looking, first of all, at what's been going on across the world in terms of policy development to strengthen the social economy as an alternative model for social and economic development and environmental sustainability. And as we know from that research, there is this growing movement of organizations, of cooperatives, nonprofits, civil society associations, credit unions and community financing organizations, and others that are proposing a different kind of framework for social, economic, and human development that integrates social, economic, and environmental considerations and posits a more people-centered approach to how we need to be thinking about the futures of our communities and of our countries and indeed of the world. And one important finding that came out of the research that we've done is that the most successful models in terms of pursuing these kinds of objectives and outcomes are where democratic governance and movement building has really been a focus for uniting the different subsectors mm-hmm. of the social economy in a more concerted effort mm-hmm. to promote these shared objectives for more equitable and social justice. The two policy papers that we have produced, which were authored by Crystal Tremblay at the University of Victoria, are available on our website, and so people can access those in terms of more in-depth background research. What we found in that research, and more recently in the work that Alex and I have been doing, is that there have been significant advances and outcomes in a number of jurisdictions, both in Canada and in other places, in terms of real social and economic improvements in conditions for people and communities, where the social and solidarity economy, as it's called in America and some other parts of the world, have become a central focus for uniting people in civil society associations, in community development organizations, in the cooperative movement amongst indigenous people's organizations. And that there's been quite a considerable success in places like the European Union, in Brazil, in Quebec, in some Asian and African countries, where those different subsectors of the social economy have created really effective democratic platforms for combining and uniting in common efforts to create more equitable social and economic development strategies. And there is evidence of a considerable shift in governmental or public policy in recognizing the social economy as a major arm, a major pillar of addressing the social, economic, and environmental challenges that people face in various parts of the world. So those stronger outcomes and impacts as a result of a more unified governance and partnership structure have certain key functions and attributes that seem to be particularly important. So I'm just going to go through what, from our research, some of those key factors are that might be lessons for action that we take together here in the Canadian environment, whether at a local or a provincial or a national level. The first one, I think, that's really important has been a focus on movement building to achieve common values and objectives for socioeconomic change. Mm-hmm. So in some jurisdictions where there's very fragmented and siloed approaches by, for example, the nonprofit and charitable sector, the cooperative sector, the credit union and community financial sector, there have not been as significant outcomes. Where those different subsectors of the social economy have been united around building a common movement, there seems to have been more significant outcomes. So the emphasis in those jurisdictions like Brazil and Quebec and in many places in the European Union has not been on just paying attention to the needs of those different sectors, but it's been more on building a common movement for social and economic change. The second key aspect that seems to be important is that there has been a particular attention to public and stakeholder engagement to bring increasing numbers of players into a common tent. And there's been a real significant strategy in some of the European countries and some of the Latin American countries, and we note in Quebec and Manitoba as well, to really reach out to and include some of those sectors of the nonprofits, the cooperative movement, etc., and build alliances with civil society associations concerned with environmental sustainability, concerned with equal rights and the participation of women and indigenous peoples, etc. There's also been a particular attention paid to broadening awareness of the social economy as something that's kind of connected together and is different from government and different from the private sector amongst the public. So a real attention to communicating to the public the existence of this sector that's been around, of course, for forever, but which can be a united force for improving and bettering the conditions of our society and our communities. The third area that seems to be important is increasingly sophisticated mechanisms to purposefully co-construct public policy with all levels of government to enhance the enabling environment for the social economy. Building of learning, education, and research capacity to mobilize knowledge and bring new generations of practitioners into the movement's also been a common focus, as has the development of capital financing and technical assistance capacity to scale up social economy organizations and their production of goods and services for the benefit of people and society. And linked to that is some very important efforts to increase the market share of social economy organizations in their contribution to the economy. And then finally, I think there's been a real attention in those jurisdictions where there have been leaps and bounds in both the internal strength and the impact of the social economy to democratic inclusion and the participation of people and organizations at all levels, but with particular attention to the grassroots. So in the paper that we produced for the summit, you'll see that there are 8 draft propositions at the end of that paper. I'm not going to go through the whole list, but I just want to say that what we're suggesting in that paper is that we really do need to pay attention to strengthening our capacity and our impacts, outputs, and outcomes as a united movement. We need to build a national space and provincial and local spaces for movement building across social economy organizations. And I know from meetings and visits to various parts of the country that people are really grappling with this issue in the faces of the challenges that their people and their communities and their organizations face, whether it's in Atlantic Canada or Nunavut or here on Vancouver Island in British Columbia, where I am. So this is a very live agenda, and we think it's a very important one. And we think that we need to be paying attention to how we create this bigger tent, this unifying space for people to come together on common objectives. We also think that we need to pay attention to better communications, a communication strategy on a pan-Canadian level to promote the social economy and its value. And then there are a number of propositions in the paper that deal with the need for initiatives that build learning opportunities, that build research capacity, that build and scale up our capacity to trade. We know from consumer research that people are voting with their wallets for ethical and fair trade products, and we think we can build on that interest by the Canadian public in strengthening the way in which we achieve greater markets. And then finally, there are propositions there on financing and engagement. So there are eight draft propositions that we're welcoming discussion on in the summit paper. But I'm going to finish there and hand over to my colleague, Alexandra Charron, to talk a little bit about the two examples that we did some more in-depth looking at, which were in Manitoba and Quebec. Over to you, Alex.
Thanks, Rupert.
It's just, Leslie, I forgot to introduce Alexandra, as the international coordinator for the Canadian CED network. And we are planning to reserve 20 minutes for discussion and questions at the end. So please consider that as you're talking.
Okay, I'll try to be brief. Thanks. So as Rupert mentioned, I focused in my research on specifically on the cases of Manitoba and Quebec as examples of policy co-construction by government and civil society. And specifically, the two sets of related questions that were my touchstones for research and that will be for what I'm going to talk about briefly here are what led to policy development and what the role of social economy, the organization of social economy movement within this, the first set of related questions. And the second, what is this policy? What are they? And what is the role of an organized social economy movement in the delivery of proactive policy measures? So I think there's a commonality that Quebec and Manitoba examples share in how policy was developed and what the role of the social economy movement was within this. So in the first place, we have what's common between the two is a very progressive government political climate. So in Quebec, from 1998 and the summit on the economy and the employment, which the Bouchard government, Parti Québécois government organized, what was sort of a reaching out to civil society and the social economy movement. And similarly, around the same time, in 1999, with the advent of the Duer government in Manitoba, the NDP government, you have, again, a very proactive government reaching out to the social economy in that region. But I think the differences, the similarities sort of end there. The differences between how the civil society has responded in both of the provinces, I believe, are illustrative. So what happened in Quebec is that you had a prior, a very deep organization of the social economy movement. Obviously, cooperatives that have roots that go back 100 years or more in Quebec, but even more recently, just prior to the convening, what we could call the convening of the social economy movement in Quebec by the Parti Québécois, there was a very sort of deep organization that was happening. The cooperatives were getting increasingly organized, is one thing. You had things like women's movements organizing with the Bread and Roses March, which was another thing, which was an example of social movements reaching into economic issues. So this was sort of the first example of this happening, or a prime example of this happening, where the women's movement started to see that economic conditions were fundamental to the whole problematic. So you have a very, very deep organization occurring there. So by the time that the Bouchard government is able to convene the social economy movement, we have one that's very organized and that's able to come together under the Chantier de l'Économie Sociale, which was, you know, which grew out of the group that was convened for the summit. So they're able to respond to government. And there's several advantages to having an organized movement like this. Specifically, the research points to that having such an organized movement gave a clear interlocutor to government. The government could interact easily with this movement and consult with civil society in this way. So to have another a large body there. So that was fundamental. And the policy outcomes, which I'll go to in a minute, are an outgrowth of this. In Manitoba, the case is a little bit different. Again, the proactive government, Gary Doer's government, reaches out. The movement, however, there is a little bit more fragmented, as the research indicates. So we have a sector that's made up of representatives of individual subsectors, but there's no unifying body that's able to bring all these actors together as we have in Quebec. So, for example, there's a myriad of Aboriginal representatives. The urban CED organizations are represented. The credit unions have a movement. The cooperatives have a movement under the Manitoba Council for Cooperatives. So the various subsectors are represented, but without the movement being unified under one of them. But another key factor in Manitoba as well that led to progressive policy development, this is very important, the research points to this, is that the integration of social economy activists within the government. So the government appointed various people who had backgrounds in social economy activism and work. Shauna McKinnon is an example of this. Were appointed to key positions within the government where they were able to advocate for social economy measures. So that's a difference there. But the research also indicates that in Manitoba, the government, to some extent, is ahead of the social economy movement. So it's there's even a little bit of a lag there between the room that's created by government and the traction that it creates within the how the social economy movement is able to respond to this. Okay, so I'm just going to go briefly, I think I have a few minutes left, into what the different policies were and how the social economy is involved in the delivery of these. So in both cases, there's a similarity in that the policies that are being delivered, the social economy movement has a lot of ownership over how they are delivered. So in Quebec, a prime example of this is finance. So the Chantier actually has a large amount of control over the financial support that the social economy is given, fundamentally through two big programs, the FIDUCY and RISC, which provide important startup financing and other technical support loans and that kind of thing to allow the social economy organizations to raise capital and to leverage existing capital. In Manitoba, we have a similar ownership because the government has been very careful in integrating the social economy in the delivery of its policies. It has done this by giving core funding to already existing CED organizations, fundamentally, and also it's gone out of its way to try to create local development organizations and groups which govern the administration of finance and other things. So some other things I could mention in terms of how the social economy is involved in delivering the policy supports and measures. In Quebec, we have priority given to social economy organizations in the delivery of services such as child care and home care. And you have funds set aside for social economy development in sort of mainstream business development organizations. The local development centers have funds set aside specifically for development of social enterprise, for example. And then in Manitoba, additionally, some things that I should mention are the CED framework and lens which the government has implemented, which allows specifically the framework gives a structure to delivery of social economy programs, and the lens targets the integration of social economy lens, specifically a social economy focus, within all government ministries and agencies. So that's another measure there. And I think I should probably stop there, yeah?
I was just going to ask, yes, if you wouldn't mind, and
Okay. Make
sure that we have time for Mike Lewis. So thank you both, Rupert and Alexandra, for your presentation, and we'll look forward to questions. So Mike Lewis, Managing Director of the Canadian Centre for Community Renewal and Director and Lead Investigator for the Balta Node of the Research Network, is speaking next.
Thank you. If I were to summarize what we've heard so far, I go back to an old adage that one of the most famous community organizers in North America from several decades ago said, Saul Alinsky, if we're not organized, we will not contend. And it seems to me that the kinds of lessons that have been put out by Rupert and Alex point to that really basic point. And I think that this is kind of a key motivation going forward as we prepare to go to the summit. The various tools and functions, whether it's social finance, social entrepreneurship, community economic development, the cooperative movement, social enterprise, have been having several national conferences over the last few years, and some of us were a bit concerned about, okay, are we just fracturing into silos, or are we going to have a basis upon which we federate and have a more unified voice? So, in a sense, the things that you've said thus far, Alex and Rupert, I think are part of the motivating context, if you will, for the National Summit coming up. I want to take my time to really raise questions. I understand the things that have been said, and I agree with the lessons, and certainly have been exposed to them in their evolution over a long period of time. But I think we're facing an unprecedented kind of context globally, and that as I've read all of the papers associated with the preparation for the National Summit, including the one that Rupert and I worked on, primarily Rupert did the work, there's some questions that, or assumptions, that I think we're not dealing with. And I think that our fundamental assumptions and the analysis that we have will shape the kinds of strategies and the way in which we federate our efforts. And thus I want to raise those just for discussion and debate. The first one is that given the challenges we're facing, in particular I would suggest around such matters as peak oil and what I expect to be rapidly escalating prices in fuel and energy costs, climate change, the whole notion of economic growth as the dominant paradigm through which we have kind of grown up, if you will, individually as families, as households, and as societies in the history that we are embedded in, is increasingly questionable as an assumption going forward. And so I'm putting that out there as one issue that is not grappled with in many of or any of the papers going into the National Summit. So that's an interesting and I think fundamental question and really does create a debate within this movement. The second thing is that the implications of these broad cross-cutting trends of escalating energy costs and declining accessibility, particularly related to fossil fuels and oil in particular, coupled with climate change, are going to be increasingly disruptive to the global economy. And the areas in which much of our work has been done in local and regional areas and which we're attempting to federate is going to, I think, serve us well, but not without difficulties. These trends are going to drive us to reinvent our economies on a much more local and regional basis. Any of you that may have caught the book Why Your World is About to Get a Whole Lot Smaller by Jeff Rubin, former chief economist for world markets for CIBC, a really mainline economist, he makes the points very well from an economic standpoint. But what it means, I think, for us is that there's some really broad implications around basic needs in terms of food, energy, finance, and shelter. Many of the things that we are engaged with and are concerned about in the social economy movement, among others. And the third issue that I'll make some very brief comments on is related to the nature of Canada as a highly decentralized federation. And what does this mean for us as we try to go forward to the summit around a national approach? So I'm not going to say a lot except about the economic growth piece, except to say that, you know, part of our challenge is that our institutions, our markets, our attitudes are adapted to a paradigm of economic growth based on cheap and accessible energy, and that this is not our future. And that creates a difficulty for us because imagining a non-growth economy, or as John Stuart Mill over 100 years coined it, a steady state economy, is difficult indeed. And we're faced with some central conundrums there, both culturally, economically, and socially. And having said that, you know, as I said previously, very few of the papers approach this question. We talk about sustainable development, but we don't clarify any of the issues around economic growth and the difficulties of transition that I think that we are facing, and increasing numbers of people and institutions and various sectors believe that we're facing. We draw from a social justice foundation in our movement. We want to make things better for people at the bottom, for those that are excluded. We want to create healthier communities. But in a sense, we have to reframe, it seems to me, the social justice orientation pretty radically, given the bankruptcy of economic growth as a paradigm. And that's a big challenge, and there's no simple answers to that. I'm not going to go into any of the evidence related to peak oil or climate change. It's certainly I've written on it, and many, many, many people are writing on it in terms of their implications. But as I said earlier, the whole notion of building a movement and building partnerships for transition to a different kind of reality that is not part of our everyday thinking is going to be very important. So how do we target not only within the movement and unifying the movement, but the reaching out to the networks and people that are not included, and who might they be? And it seems to me these are very important questions. So in those basic need areas related to food, to finance, to you know, land tenure reform and housing, agriculture, implications of that, and shelter, these are areas, some of which are reflected in our movement, but which I think, from a movement-building point of view, are going to require a whole lot more targeted and outreach and inclusion and dialogue to build the kind of federated capacity and linkages that are necessary if we're going to contend, given the challenges we face. The last thing that I would say, and it's a big question, I think, Alex talked about Manitoba. He talked about Quebec. One could say to some extent, at least in the co-op movement, the way in which it's federated across several areas in Nova Scotia. All of these places are pointing to the kind of federated capacity that can mobilize resources and manage resources in important ways. And these are very important going forward. But in many other parts of the country, you know, some of us, certainly myself, spent years working to build a national kind of community economic development network. But one of the things that Nancy Neimpton always challenged me on, and Nancy is the president of the Chantier L'Economie Sociale, she'd say, Mike, why don't you spend more time organizing in British Columbia? Because regionally, if we don't have networks, given the decentralized nature of the federation we live in, that we can get strong and robust on in our provinces and regions, we are going to have some. We can't build a strong national movement in a country such as Canada. So I think this third question about where do we put our priorities going forward, given the fact that we've got a national summit coming up, and the importance of some of the propositions that you would see in the discussion paper, such as, you know, the kind of a national way of federating these various parts of our movement. If we don't concentrate concurrently, or potentially even give an emphasis to, in some parts of the country, building a much more interlinked, interconnected, and organized network of networks in the provinces where we live, and given the broader trends that I talked about and their implications for making our world a whole lot smaller, there's an interesting debate to be had as to priorities for organizing and federating our efforts. That's it for now.
Thank you very much. So I'd like to thank all the speakers, and you've certainly given us a lot to think about, and the discussion can begin here, and of course it will be continued at the summit, and no doubt after the summit there will be opportunities to have further input. So if you would like to ask a question, please just unmute your phone by doing *6 and pose your question.
Hello, this is Khan Rahi from Toronto. I have a question for Alex. Given what Michael just described in terms of facilitating factors and impeding factors to building movements, could you describe what you meant by, in that context, that the Manitoba government and to some extent the Quebec government, you felt that they were, in terms of your material, that they were ahead of social economy movements. In other words, to put it bluntly, they're ahead of the government. In this context, the state is really ahead of the people. So in the context of what Mike just described in great detail, movement building and questioning current assumptions, I was curious to how you would characterize that assessment.
Yeah. It's a little bit tricky, right? Because, like, it's hard to say where the pressure in the organizing stops and where the government response begins. But, you know, so you could talk about it from the other perspective and say that the movement really had an impact in changing government policy and the constant pressure. Certainly, in Quebec, you can make a case for the prior organization and the pressure that various movements had been putting on government for decades. You know, and co-op prior. Organization of the co-op movement and pressuring and legislative precedent that the co-op movement had set had an impact. But I sort of feel that it's really not until you get progressive and responsive governments that you have any kind of traction on any of this stuff. So so the Bouchard government in Quebec and the Duhr government in Manitoba, that's when it really starts to happen, and commentators talk about the importance of, you know, social democratic governments, and in many cases both of these governments are sort of anomalies in that, yeah, they come from even, you know, very progressive party traditions, but for some, in the case of Manitoba, with the integration of social economy activists in the government, and in Quebec, with a government that's even in many cases more progressive than previous ones, sort of that. But how it's ahead? I think that in certain cases, well, I mean, in Quebec, the convening of the social economy movement, that's when it really begins, when government decides finally to say to give the social economy a space and to begin consulting it. That's when it really starts to happen. And in the case of, I wouldn't say that the government necessarily is ahead of the social economy movement in Quebec, but I think it is the case in Manitoba. There are examples of the Manitoba government wanting, especially at the beginning, wanting to implement progressive social policy, and the social economy sector not being able to adequately organize and present, you know, sort of unified policy recommendations or organize to deliver those services. You know, there's one case of when the government felt that it wanted to deliver technical services to the social economy sector, having various proposals from the different social economy representatives, but none of which, you know, they couldn't agree on any of them. So the government sort of said, well, you need to kind of get together and decide on one that we can work on. And so the anecdote is, you know, sort of putting them in a room together until they were able to hammer out one sort of consensuated policy recommendation. So I think the anecdotal evidence, and certainly from commentators that are inside both of government and the social economy movement in Manitoba, point to the fact that the government over the years has been a little bit ahead of the social economy movement in the resources that it's willing to dedicate to it, but the fact that the social economy movement, by virtue of its fragmentation, maybe not being well positioned to respond to it. But I think that's changing and evolving, and it's getting better, but I think there's still a little bit of a gap there.
Thank you. Are there any other questions? Remember to star 6.
Well, if there are no other questions, it's Connigan from Toronto. I'll indulge in asking Michael. See, well, Mike, how do you interpret that? The fact that should we wait for more social democratic governments to move on and pave the way, or we should, like you said, basically reformulate the framework, the current framework in social enterprises, and starting looking at different strategies in order to obtain or strengthen the movement at the bottom.
Can you hear me here?
Yeah, I can hear you, sure.
Okay. Well, I would say that there's a few things that are important. I think number one, maybe Alex, you and I have a bit different perspective on this question. For instance, the Manitoba government, it's true that the progressive nature of the government was important. It's equally and importantly true that the draft national policy framework that had been developed by the Canadian CED network was in draft form when that government came into play, and that was a very, very important input into the way in which they shaped their strategy. So the work at the base that was done in the early part of this decade was absolutely important in shaping the design of some of the key features in that early stage development. The second thing I would say is that the political pressure in Quebec has absolutely been fundamental. And it goes back to the point I made at the beginning of my presentation, which is we're not organized, we won't contend. They put tremendous pressure on the government through the social movements to come to the summit that Bouchard called on the economy. And they put tremendous pressure on inside that summit, which created the political space and, in fact, forced the government in that situation to begin to respond. And the Chantier grew out of that process. Moreover, as they made progress, And as the new government came in, the initial response, particularly on the fundamental issue of daycare, which the social economy plays such a role in Quebec, you know, they tried to attack the Parti Québécois' advances in that, which had also kind of been, kind of as Alex said, it was partly progressive government, it was partly also from the pressure at the base, that, you know, the Chanté with its partners and other social movements, essentially within 1 week, had 20,000 people on the street. So, you know, this whole notion of our role politically in putting pressure on and having a basis upon which we are articulating the common ground and reaching out, as Rupert had said, into a more inclusive and federated and articulate movement, I think is absolutely important. If we wait on social democratic governments as an opening to make progress, I think, you know, we could be waiting a long time. And secondly, that doesn't take away from the things Alex said, which, of course, governments that are more progressive are going to potentially be more open to our ideas. I would remind people, though, that we have a history in British Columbia where we were making some very preliminary progress, and people like Rupert were inside that government, but I think it's fair to say that we weren't organized in British Columbia in a way that could have really took advantage of any openings we would have had, and it certainly wasn't the government that would have needed. So I think it is nuanced, but I really think that we can't, we have to be strategically opportunistic, but we've got to continue to do the work internally to build a much more robust and sophisticated set of federated linkages between various parts of this movement.
If I may jump in for a minute, it's Maddie Mayfield in Victoria. I'm a complete newcomer to these telelearning sessions, and I'm not well versed in the social economy, but I've worked for some years now in government, mostly in areas of social policy and health policy. And what I have noticed with a fairly right-wing current Liberal government, when the economy isn't there to provide them with the funds to do the things they feel would make BC the best place on earth, they do start driving very hard for things like childcare and early learning. They note fairly quickly that unless we have good childcare and good early learning, we will not be productive in the world economy. And I just gather that by grabbing at the media clippings as I do my daily work and answer to briefing notes. But there are, I think, some real opportunities in BC for things like childcare to move forward in a more cooperative, collective model. And I know that this government has actually started a cross-government non-profit sector initiative to try and get better bridging between the non-profit sectors and the government, because, for example, in the Ministry of Children and Family Development, 80% of our work is done by contracted non-profit agencies. So I think there are some pieces that we could work with, and they would thrive more capably if there was a social economy aspect brought into this picture. And I think you might find that there actually is a fairly strong network sitting there already looking for some different ways to be reframed and brought forward. And I do read, even with Enhancer, I read debates suggesting that because of this current economic situation and because of the fact that no government seems to have been able to sort out provincially what to do about childcare, I think they're at a point where they would be quite happy to have a different approach brought to them, and they would look at it seriously. But it's by, I think, Mike, as you were suggesting, it's by looking for these moments of finding a strategy and moving with it, and albeit you are scrambling because we don't have, you know, the appropriate infrastructure in place. We don't have solid linkages, but perhaps that's how they happen. You get on that slippery slope and you get some of them to happen and you hang on to them and then you build more. I don't think it happens in any kind of a theoretical or sort of proactive way. I just don't think so.
Well, I think it's Mike here again, just a quick response. I think those are interesting points. I think the
caution I would put out, and I think what also is really kind of key to some of the things that at the end of the Rupert's presentation, is that because of the level of organization in the field and because of the nature of the governments, this whole notion of a platform for co-constructing and co-producing public policy is really important. And I'm not going to get into comments about the BC government in this particular forum, but you know, that notion of co-construction requires both openness on the government side on the one hand, but it also requires organization on the other side. And part of the difficulties that nonprofits and various sectors are facing in several sectors is this same problem that you're referring to, that the government's facing in terms of resources. In both Manitoba and in Quebec, part of the key investments that government has made and has continued to make is in the financing and helping to finance that infrastructure that keeps the glue together.
Right.
Without that, it's very difficult, and that's part of the challenge we have in some of the various jurisdictions in Canada, is that the mechanisms for investment, given the you know, given the financial situation of many of the people in the movement, to be self-financing, we're not quite there yet, and thus government has a very important role to play. So it's an attitudinal thing around and a structural thing for co-constructing, but there also needs to be a way in which the work required to organize and then maintain a robust interlinked sector has to find financing, and that's difficult to do in many jurisdictions.
Right. Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you for your question. Any other people would like to ask questions? Remember, star 6.
Hello, it's Brenda Cameron Coots with Imagine Canada, and I would just like to draw your attention and to comment. We're in the midst of undertaking a an engagement strategy, if you will, trying to bring nonprofits and charities together around common issues. And I think one of the, you know, it, and I don't have the answer to this. If we did, we wouldn't need to be doing this. But is around moving people from their individual organization to collective action. And it's, I think, a huge challenge. What we have done is developed a document called the Framework for Action, which we have identified seven drivers of change for the sector, and these would be common issues that would cut across, regardless of whether you're an arts organization or a health group or a sports or a community economic development, and we'll be working on that project this year, and but certainly some of the things that will be done at the summit, of which I will participate, also cross into some of the other areas that affect nonprofits across the country. But it's that issue of trying to get that call to action or having people see the benefit of collective action on any number of things that I think will have an impact on this work and the broader work of charities and nonprofits across the country.
Thank you. And anyone else ready to ask a question? Well, I guess I could ask one. I was interested in the papers, the importance of creating a space for the social economy to talk to each other, those actors in the social economy, to talk to one another. And I was just wondering if you could draw out maybe some good examples of how that takes place, particularly if we're talking across sectors, across the nonprofit and the charity and the mutuals and the co-ops and credit unions. And I guess maybe, I don't know, whoever would like to answer.
Hello?
Go ahead, Rupert.
Ah, it's not an answer.
Sorry, I got cut out there. How to create that space? Well, it seems to me that in Brazil is very interesting. It's obviously in a very different part of the world, but it has a very similar federal structure to what we have in Canada. And there were two or three important contributing factors to the strength of that space, the Solidarity Economy Network. One was the attention to building up from the grassroots, that there is a very strong federated, localized series of bases or spaces for people to work together in the Brazilian regions and at the local level. They actually call them incubating spaces in Portuguese, and I can't remember what that is in Portuguese, but they use the term incubating spaces. So they kind of consciously focus on the need for building locally these spaces for people to come together and create their own strategies and create their own initiatives that are mostly grassroots community organizations, but also civil society associations. And they consciously engage the universities and colleges as partners in that work. And they engage local and regional government folks as well. And so they have a federated structure that builds on this base, very strong base, and then articulates it at a federal level to address the national issues, learning from what's going on at a local level. And the second important thing that's really important in the Brazilian example is the attention that they paid, as you would expect from Brazil, given its history, to active peer learning, that really trying to engage people in learning from one another as they do their work, and creating innovative and creative mechanisms for that to happen. And some of that happens with in partnership with universities, and some of it doesn't. Some of it's very much embedded and led by civil society organizations. But it's a real attention to the practice of learning and movement building that we can learn a lot from Brazil. And then the third thing, just to speak to this dialogue we've been having on those kind of political dimensions, is that they're very clear about their separation from the state, that they're building an independent and autonomous grassroots-led civil society movement for the social and solidarity economy that creates a space to influence all types of partisan politics and all types of levels of political engagement. But they're very careful about protecting the space from being taken over by partisan interests. And so they're seen in the public eye as being independent of political parties and traditional political interests. And that seems to be a very important ingredient in creating that kind of unifying space that has traction and respect from all kinds of elements of the public. So I'll stop there.
Oh, thank you. Very helpful. I see that we're out of time, so I think the chat room, maybe, Rachelle, can you tell me if people can continue to talk on the chat room for a little while?
Yeah, the chat room will be open all day if you want to continue posting resources and talking amongst yourselves.
Okay, so that's one resource. And also the audio file of this this session will be up on the SEDNET site and also on the Social Economy Hub site. And we can put those addresses into the chat room for you. So you can follow up there. And then, of course, many of you will be up. So I'd like to thank our speakers, Mike Lewis and Alex and Rupert Downing, and the people who were on the call, and Rachelle for all your organizing of it. Really appreciate it. So goodbye, everyone, and see you at the summit.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.